At a later date, about a year later, I had another conversation with him, and found that he was partly on the fifth sub-level, surrounded with books and studying theosophy. He mentioned a well-known man of science whose acquaintance he had made there. He frequently came down onto the fourth subplane to visit old friends, and was beginning, I gathered, to be set to work, sharing in that enormous volume of work undertaken by all who are qualified, and not preoccupied by work of a still higher order, the task of soothing and encouraging people who come over from this life in complete ignorance of all that appertains to the real truth of things, and are at first frightened and bewildered even if they are not required by circumstances to endure actual suffering. 31. A wonderful recovery. I will now attempt to give some idea of after-death experiences differing as widely as the poles asunder from the case just described. Here again I myself was acquainted in life with the person in question, and knew him to be tainted with evil doing of unusual intensity. Indeed, I had good reason to believe him definitely enlisted in the service of evil, nothing more or less than a black magician. He was about the last person I should have thought of as likely to be brought to speak to me through the channel which, during the last few years, has been made use of to keep me in relation with the occult world. But, to my immense surprise, he was so brought on one occasion under conditions that I must stop for a moment to explain. The method of communication referred to was mainly designed in the first instance to keep me in touch with the great Master 232, whom I am especially attached, and with others of the White Lodge, but it is used, as the stories I have already told will have shown, to provide for intercourse with friends who have passed on and other inhabitants of the astral world. For it is possible for certain persons belonging to the White Lodge, whom I may describe as lieutenants of the Masters, to bring any astral entity willing to come for a talk with me, and more than this, to bring the higher self of the living person with whom I have been able this way in some cases to communicate, while the person concerned has actually been awake on the physical plane. In other cases, when the person concerned has been asleep and out of the body in the astral vehicle, it has been the personality itself that has been brought. On the occasion referred to above, it was the actual personality of my dark acquaintance, still then living, M. N. Let me call him, who spoke to me, to my no little amazement. And he spoke without the least disguise of his true character. I expressed my surprise as soon as he enabled me to identify him. He chuckled, if I may use that word to convey an idea of his mental attitude, and said he had come to torture me for a bit. He knew, of course, that I knew how seriously he had injured some friends of 33, mine, and I gathered that he had plans in view for inflicting further injuries on one of them, and proposed to amuse himself by sketching out his plan. I scoffed at him, declaring that he could only have come by permission of my loftier friends, and that he was perfectly powerless to hurt me. He laughed in turn, and said he had come because he chose to come, to talk to me about her whom he supposed I should call his victim. To that term I agreed, as I looked upon him as altogether evil. This view he quite complacently accepted, claiming to represent the devil. I used very contemptuous language, calling him a fool for his pains, who was earning disastrous consequences for himself in a long run. All that he ridiculed as Sunday school prattle, and was going on to say something else when he suddenly broke off. What was that I was going to say? It has all been wiped out of my mind. He went on repeating this idea with increasing irritation. I told him the experience was clearly a lesson to show him that he was powerless in the hands of the great adepts. Immediately afterwards he was gone. One of my occult friends, of the order I have described as lieutenants of the Masters, then told me that the black visitor had been brought, 34, by him in accordance with the Master's direction, for the sake of the lesson he had just received, which might have a startling effect, and indeed the Master himself afterwards told me it might be the first step for him in an upward progress. I thought no more about the matter for some long while, but about a year and a half later I learned that the man in question had died, at a date some 4 or 5 months later than that of the interview I have described. And he had died altogether in the odor of sanctity, so to speak. He had undertaken a work of a painfully self-sacrificial nature, had dazzled with admiration or who were cognizant of his doings, and had finally lost his life, though only in early middle age, in pursuance of his very ghastly, self-imposed duty. It was all utterly bewildering, and I need hardly say that I sought for an explanation of the mystery. The development now reached was profoundly touching. He himself was brought to me again, and our conversation was indeed different from the last. He asked at first for a few moments to recover. I am unwilling to repeat the whole of the conversation in detail, as that would disclose his identity for some who may read these lines in a manner which is perhaps undesirable. What he told me was in substance, 35, to this effect: after returning to the body from the previous interview he had with me, the influences that had then been brought to bear upon him had had the effect of evoking a mysterious change. He somehow seemed to realize the horror of the life he had been leading. He resolved to change its entire course, to devote himself thenceforward to the service of humanity instead of to that of the black powers with whom till then he had been working. He had been in that terrible service for a long series of lives. He now undertook a task of so desperately trying a nature that he knew it would involve the ultimate sacrifice of his own life under very painful conditions. He carried it through to the end, and then faced the after-death consequences of the long career of evil-doing in which he had been immersed. This meant a period of suffering on the second submerged plane of the astral world. He gave me an awful account of the torments he was undergoing. He was in the dim lurid light of the underworld, surrounded by horrible elemental shapes or creatures of the most loathsome aspect who were attacking him fiercely. He had lost all sense of time, but this seemed to have been going on for what seemed an eternity. But he realized his suffering to be an expiation that, 36, had to be borne. He was dauntless in the courage with which he faced it. The wonderful strength of his character that had made him, till then, so powerful a force on the black side, now took the shape of a tenacious resolution to bear whatever might befall him without flinching or turning aside from the determination that he would at last set his foot on the first rung of the ladder leading to the spiritual heights of the White Lodge. He rejoiced in the brief interlude that his present visit to me afforded, but was going back to the awful region he had described to me with unwavering bravery. This interview took place, as far as I could make out, about a year and a half after his physical death, and I have since learned that it marked the moment of his actual release from the underworld. His stay there would not have wiped out the awful karma of his black magic lives if it had not been for the fact of his genuine repentance in physical life and his many months of painful self-sacrifice voluntarily incurred. The experience was abnormal in all ways. Leaving black magicians out of account, the karma that leads to any contact with the terrible second sub-plane of the astral is exceptional in its character. I have said already, 37, in general terms, that it is only the very worst specimens of humanity that have anything to do with this dreadful region after death, but that statement does not cover the whole ground. Human characters are often complicated in their constitution. A man may have a great deal of good in his nature blemished by some abominable characteristics, and one above all is calculated to give the person so affected a period of suffering on the second sublevel. The characteristic to which I refer is cruelty, cruelty during life on the physical plane. The principle will be readily intelligible. The most beautiful human emotion is love. The behavior in life which that emotion prompts is benevolence, kindness to others, sympathy, and all the varieties of that characteristic. When the love principle is missing from the nature, the result may be callous indifference to suffering in others, sometimes leading to acts of positive cruelty. Then, just as active love is a force, leading to blissful conditions of astral existence, active cruelty leads to a glimpse of, or a more protracted sojourn on the terrible second sublevel. I shall have to amplify that explanation with examples later on, but for the moment it is enough to enunciate the idea in its broad aspects. 38, as I indicated above, M.N. was much nearer release from the awful conditions of a submerged level at the time of his second interview with me than he imagined. Sometime after I heard of his release, I was enabled to get touch with him again, so that I might hear from himself how he was getting on. He told me he was then on the fourth subplane, and had joined a sort of community. He described it as a monastery, the brothers of which were engaged in the effort to concentrate their thoughts into a force that could be used by higher powers for the benefit of humanity. He was happy now in performance of this task. Before going on with the record of other experiences, this may be a suitable time for giving some explanation of the conditions under which the terrible regions of the underworld are governed. The wild caricature of these regions embodied in ecclesiastical theology assumes that hell is governed by the devil, who takes a delight in torturing his victims. This is so grotesque a perversion of the truth that one cannot easily understand how even the moderate intelligence guiding ecclesiastical thought can have been content with the theory. Clearly, if there is a region of existence designed to be a region of suffering, where suffering has, 39, a purifying purpose, that region must be ruled by divine will, not by any diabolical agency reveling in cruelty for its own sake. In reality, the regions of suffering are confided to the rule of a being of infinite sublimity, goodness, mercy, and love. They constitute the mighty reformatory of the world, and the being who rules them is spoken of by the great masters of wisdom themselves with deep reverence and admiration. For the stupendous duty in question would never have been imposed by divine will on any being qualified to undertake it. Its acceptance was a voluntary act of the most unparalleled self-sacrifice. He who undertook it is known in the occult world as Melang. He belongs to an order of superadepts spoken of by those who still use the beautiful old term brothers for the masters of the White Lodge, as the fathers. Incarnate imagination cannot go far in the direction of comprehending the conditions of existence, or the functions in nature of the fathers, but we may assuredly assume it to be a condition of some supreme beatitude. It was from that condition, because it was necessary that some qualified being should perform the duty, that Melang descended to rule the regions of suffering. 40. I do not suggest that even there he can in any way share the suffering, but, for a being filled by nature with love and sympathy to be the constant witness of it, in a certain sense the agent for its infliction, even though divine wisdom enables him to appreciate its purifying purpose, must mean a state of consciousness that cannot be far removed from pain. Besides the two submerged levels, the third, immediately in contact with the earth's surface, is included in Melang's realm. The lower of the two submerged levels is hardly, if at all, connected with human experience. It is chiefly a region of strange elemental life of a kind that we should regard as horrible if we had any contact with it, but I have learned next to nothing more about it. Something has already been said above concerning the second level, in connection with the experiences of M.N., but the third requires much fuller treatment. It is, of course, extremely varied in its aspects. Its worst conditions are very dark and wretched. I use the word worst in preference to lowest because the lowest in the spatial sense is that part immediately in touch with the physical earth's surface, and people who cannot get away from the physical surroundings to which they have been used in life are uncomfortable. 41, certainly, but not so badly off as others also entangled with the conditions of level number 3. We shall get glimpses of what such entanglements mean as we go on with the records I have been enabled to collect. 42. Experiences of H.S. The beautiful passing of my friend W.G. might without doubt be paralleled by many other examples of similar experience. Happily, at the present stage of human evolution, there must be large numbers of people who lead thoroughly good lives and wake up on delightful regions of the astral, where they may soon be eager to express the idea that W.G. conveyed to me in the course of his talk. I wouldn't be back in the body for anything, but I have been seeking, in the course of the inquiries I have been privileged to carry on, for examples of astral experience that convey some more varied lessons than the simple old truth that good lives here lead to happy conditions hereafter. Thus, while there may be a good deal of shadow in some of the stories I am going on to tell, these need not have a discouraging effect on the minds of my readers generally. There will be more to say on that subject, 43, later, but I have now to describe some astral lives involving a good deal of what may be called purgatorial experience, Let me reserve comment on this purgatorial aspect of astral life till I have an appropriate text in the shape of the story I now want to relate. This has to do with the astral life of a man who was a close personal friend of my own in physical life. He was an older man than myself, and passed on more than 20 years ago from the time at which I am writing. He was a man of great personal charm, attractive in every way, mentally brilliant, and good-looking to correspond. Under those conditions, and filled with an intense interest in and desire for the opposite sex, the results were remarkable and striking, to say the least. Don Juan, of the poem, I used sometimes to think, with his two or three simple love adventures, had an almost ascetic record compared to that of my friend, H. S. Let me call him. The consequences to him on the astral plane after he passed over were not such as to encourage us to think lightly of tendencies along the line referred to. H. S. woke after the usual interval, and found himself in what, 44, seemed like the lounge of a great hotel, or the entrance hall of a large club. It was pervaded by a reddish-yellow light. At first he had no particular sense of discomfort, but presently he saw coming in and out of the room a number of nude female forms. These evoked passionate desire, but if he attempted to reach them they receded or disappeared. This went on for a terrible length of time. On one occasion he was endeavoring to pursue some female form down what seemed a long corridor. It narrowed, and narrowed, until it seemed like a pipe down which he was being propelled. It was a terrible nightmare feeling. Then he seemed shot out into space, and found himself in a room where there was a man, and a woman of the prostitute order. He was partially drawn into the vortex of their feeling. But the room seemed filled with red fumes that gave him a strange sensation of reaction and disgust. Then he was back again in the lounge, and everything went on as before, crowds of unclothed figures all about. At one time a voice seemed to address him, saying, "Son, you will never get satisfaction that way, shut your soul's eye and you will get relief." But he could not do this. Years went on and he suffered acutely. 45 His experience illustrated in a remarkably vivid way the principle that the astral body is the real seat of those desires we are in the habit of thinking about as the desires of the flesh. The appreciation of this truth may indeed in some cases be carried to excess. During incarnate life certain desires are in harmony with nature's design. They leave no indelible traces on the astral vehicle unless they are allowed to dominate life and thought to an excessive degree. As in so many other ways, moderation is the keynote of health. It is almost as definitely possible to overdo asceticism as to overdo self-indulgence. But the astral vehicle of H. S. was no doubt oversaturated with sexual desire, and it was by a very slow course of suffering that this unhealthy state of things was counteracted. Eventually one of those whom I may describe as lieutenants of the masters got into touch with H. S. and helped him to escape from the tantalizing torments to which he had been so long subject. Of course by that time he had become intensely desirous of escaping, or else the rescue could not have been accomplished. As it was, he was so dealt with that the room that had been so long the scene of his purgatory began to look shadowy. It was still filled with the 46 forms of women, but though they clutched at him and tried to keep him down, he shrank from them and felt himself floating upward. He seemed to hear a sound, something like a gong, and then, all the previous conditions had disappeared and he found himself in a rocky desert alone. The first feeling was awful, but presently he saw the one who had helped him, who told him to come along, that he was ready. He held my hand, H. S. told me, and life seemed to pour into me. We floated along. At the end of a valley we came out into a beautiful country. He had, in fact, been lifted out of the third level onto the fourth. The new influence gradually worked on him and created a revulsion of feeling, a disgust for the emotions that had previously controlled him. He remembers having been alone for a time. Then he came more definitely into touch with former friends who had already become established on higher levels, and so by degrees into the companionship of entities belonging to the White Lodge. During life he had known something of occult teaching, and the effect of this blossomed forth when he had struggled through the embarrassments of sexual passion. Now, of course, for many years, 47. He has been engaged in loftier pursuits, and on the usual task of helping other people coming up from the lower world, and needing such help as his own experiences enable him to give. 48. The story of R.W. I now approach a very difficult task, that of describing the after-death experiences of a lady who was brought to talk to me in response to a wish on my part to get speech with someone whose story would be a feminine pendant to that of my friend H.S., a woman whose life had been in a preeminent degree colored by strong sexual passion. Let me again emphasize the idea that, exhaled within the limits of any reasonable moderation, no bad karma whatever attaches to the exercise of natural functions, nor even to the intense enjoyment of these as associated with genuine love, of which indeed they are the almost inevitable expression on the physical plane of life. I might go even further than this if called upon to write an essay on the relations of the sexes, so grievously mismanaged under the influence of various delusive conventions, especially in this country. But some, 49, fundamental laws may be recognized in connection with all problems of this nature. Firstly, that selfish pleasure, sought at the expense of incidental suffering to another, engenders bad karma of an unequivocal character, the effects of which will color the next physical life, while, independently of that, desires innocent in themselves, may be exaggerated in their intensity and allowed to dominate a whole life to such an extent that they are shed with very great difficulty on the astral plane after the death of the physical body. The process of shedding them may be so painful and protracted, as the story I have just been dealing with shows, that an account of it in any particular case reads like the description of a punishment, but that would not be a correct reading of it. The consequences of evil doing on the physical plane, which have to be regarded, from one point of view, as its penalty, are worked out on the physical plane again in the next life. The intervening period is one the conditions of which ought to reflect the better side of the life just spent, rather than its worst. But for that better side to express itself, the entity must not be weighed down by characteristics incompatible with existence on the higher levels of the astral world. It cannot, 50, get up to those higher levels still free of the characteristics which belong exclusively to the earth life. That is how it comes to pass that the entity is entangled with thought forms on the third level, in the way H.S. was entangled, till that group of desires has been worn out. I will go on now with the narrative I was enabled to obtain from the lady who, as I put it above, was a counterpart, on the feminine side, of my friend H.S. She remembered her death, which she struggled against. Felt herself pushed out of her body, and saw it die, sank into a state of unconsciousness, and afterwards woke feeling very unhappy. She found herself surrounded by a dull red light, and saw male forms around in all directions. This sight roused the old desires with intensity. She rushed towards them, but they receded. I must leave a good deal here to the imagination of the reader. Fiercely craving for satisfaction, she found herself drawn into an eddy or swirl which drew her into the neighborhood of a soldier and girl in Hyde Park. She threw herself into the girl's aura. The girl had been somewhat reluctant, but now gave herself up to the man. Desire seemed to burn her like acid on the skin. I cannot follow the painful story in all, 51, details. She was fearfully tormented by thought forms of a horrible character, the creation of her imagination during life. These at last provoked a feeling of abhorrence. She found herself alone in a rocky desert, utterly miserable. Eventually she was addressed by a tall black figure who told her she was in his charge, but that it rested with her to determine how long she would remain on these levels of misery. He asked, did she wish to escape from these tormenting desires? She could only gasp out an entreaty to him to get her out of this. He said, it is well, follow me, the way is long. But if you obey, you will find a path that will lead you away. As soon as I depart, you will be again tormented by the personifications of your old desires. They will seem real, they will attempt to seduce you. Bear in mind that they cannot, if your desire for freedom remains. Hold fast to that. Then she found herself surrounded by red flowers, red grass, red everything, and men whether saying come, etc. But she resisted. Melan again appeared, saying, "It is well. Rest and recover." Then he touched her forehead, and a wave of peace seemed to flow over her. Then she saw a lovely woman in white, who smiled on her and took her in her arms. 52. She floated up, and attained some region of bliss, a lovely garden, where she was filled with a new sense of life and cleanliness. This must, of course, have been some level of the fourth subplane, and thither she now returns at will, but she has devoted herself to work on the lower planes, where she endeavors to help those whom she misled in life. I cannot ascertain exactly how long the suffering period lasted, but believe it must have been for several years of our time. 53. J. P. S. Story. The astral life with which I will now proceed to deal was one which I sought to investigate because it was that of a man who led an utterly commonplace life, concerned merely with the ordinary amusements of a man about town, with racing, games, and club life generally. There was nothing that I knew of conspicuously wrong in his behavior, but he was a man who probably never gave a thought to interests of a higher order than those of the physical plane, and my valued friend G. R. found him for me about a year after his passing over, and brought him along for a talk. He was very glad to find himself in a position to talk freely with someone on the physical plane. He identified himself with joyful readiness, and addressed me by name, vividly remembering all about his life just spent. "I am not happy," he told me. "I, 54, will proceed to give his story, as far as I can, in his own words, hurriedly noted at the time of our interview, and freely interlarded with the harmless swear words he was wont to strew about his conversation with liberal abundance. I am still haunting the damned club, bored to death." I asked what were his first recollections. "I remember being awfully confused at first, couldn't realize that I was dead. You know, I died rather suddenly, some sort of fit, I believe the doctors called it. Then I know I had a sort of sleep for a time, and when I woke I was in one of those big armchairs at the club. One of those near the fire, you know, in the smoking room. Then, damned if some fellow did not sit down right on top of me, or through me. It was that beastly fat old colonel who used to play billiards. The old fool said, 'What a draft, shut the door.' There wasn't any draft. I went to the billiard room, and wanted to play, but if I tried to take up a cue it slipped through my fingers. I looked on sometimes at all of you having lunch or dinner. I wanted to join in, but it was no good. If I got hold of anything, it all went to nothing in my fingers, like one of those damned, 55, pastry cook's puffs with nothing inside. I wanted to cut off the joint." In life, of course, he had been quite unable to take a serious view of the subjects with which he knew I was concerned, and now he felt how much better it might have been for him if he had been able. But he went on to explain how he had been just now addressed by someone he did not know. "Who the devil are you?" he asked, and the person asked him to come along and have a talk with me. "You're the first person I've met," he said, "who has given me an intelligible answer." He was then brought to me, and was utterly bewildered as to how it was that he found himself talking to me. I endeavored to explain as far as it was possible to make him understand, giving him good advice as to how he could get clear of the club and aspire towards superior conditions in the new world of which he had just touched the threshold, and recommended him to seek out a certain person whom we both knew in life, another member of our club, who had passed on 2 or 3 years before. This friend had a mind a good deal better open to serious ideas than J. P., as I will call him, but nonetheless was worried for a time at not being able to get away from the club, where he had spent much, 56, of his waking life. J. P. did not know what to do in order to find R. N., as I will call him, but I told him to think of R. N. intently, and that would attract his attention. Meanwhile he went on to tell me that some mysterious person had, on one occasion, shown him an awful sight, something that looked like a huge pit, and, looking down, he saw horrid reptiles, scorpions, and great octopuses, and he was told he had had the good luck to escape going down there by a hair's breadth. He shuddered. 10 minutes down there would have knocked me silly. Referring to his life on this plane, he said, "I was an empty sort of numbskull, but I played the game, had some sense of honor, but when is this wheel going to stop? I'm about fed up with it. I don't want to go back to that damned club. I again told him to look out for R.N., and suddenly he called out, "Why, there is R.N.," using a nickname by which he was known to his intimates. Then R.N.